she was defenceless, she was unarmed, she was on her own doorstep.
Crystal Heart was in the beginning of her life, everything to look forward to, until it was taken away in the most inane, pointless and brutal manner.
We saw him with the gun in his hand, we heard the shots, and we saw him leave with the gun in his hand.
It's just wrong place, wrong time.
It was just a question of finding him. It was, you know, literally was a manhunt.
It was a crime of almost breathtaking callousness.
The man who tried to kill her will never be free to harm
him. The audio was too graphic to be broadcast.
Colin Sutton was a detective chief inspector and senior investigating officer in the Metropolitan Police. He led the investigations into some of the most complex and high-profile cases ever, bringing dangerous criminals to justice.
Then heard screaming, the night stalker pulls out the gun. Another 146 victims.
In this series, he will take you inside those cases and show you how he caught these criminals using nothing but pure detective work. This is The Real Manhunter.
Now been found guilty on all 29 of those charges.
August 1589. The officer in charge described it as a senseless tragedy.
The life sentence may provide some closure for his victims' families.
This case came to us at Easter 2007. It was the beginning of April. It was Good Friday, and we were on call in the office at Putney, and we had a skeleton staff because it was a bank holiday, and it was a fine, glorious day in early April. And unusually, at 10 or so in the morning, 10:30, we get a phone call saying, we need you to deploy to a shooting on Battersea, on South Area. At that time, we were still getting the Levi Belfield case ready for court, still investigating it to a degree. But as was the practice, you know, we had to take our share of new investigations. So we were taking some new investigations, and indeed we were doing our on-call week. So we were on call.
I was in the office, we got a call that a young girl had been shot.
I said, OK, yeah, that's right. Any more information? They said, well, the victim is a 22-year-old woman called Crystal Heart. I remember my first question to them being, do we know if it's a gang-related case? And they said, no, we think that it's definitely not gang-related. I kind of didn't have a whole team there because you have, like, a minimum strength skeleton staff. So I took what officers I had with me, and one of them was Joe Brunt, of course, who was there.
I'm a retired detective, used to work on the murder squad for 10 years. Apparently, I wanted to join the police as soon as I could talk. I think it was Juliet Bravo, the programme, that made me want to join the police, but I always wanted to join the police. Started in 1987 and ended it in 2017, having spent probably 28 years as a detective.
Joe Brunt was somebody that I relied upon from the Levi Belfield case, and I was glad that she was available and there to come with me. Belfield Road is in this safe, nice part of London, an up-and-coming area with lots of young professionals and families. There are so many nannies and au pairs pushing their charges about the streets and here on Wandsworth Common that the area is known as Nappy Valley. It's possibly one of the last places you'd think any murder would take place in London.
We arrived at this crime scene, which had been cordoned off before our arrival, and we met with a colleague of ours, basically explained they believed at that stage it was a neighbour dispute.
When we turn out to a new inquiry, it's always tinged with sadness because you know somebody has lost their life. But when we found out the circumstances surrounding Crystal's murder, it was just apparent what a real, absolute tragedy and senseless waste of life this one was. It was just, you know, the sort of tragedy that even experienced murder squad detectives like my team, we were shocked by it.
The local DI was here. He was an ex-murder squad detective, and he just explained that they'd already found out exactly what had happened.
Crystal Heart was born and grew up in Battersea in southwest London. She was part of a quite large extended family, and it was in many ways a traditional London family, with people always supporting each other, family events, and they were very close. And she had been working as a secretary. She worked in the office of the then Deputy Prime Minister, John Prescott, at one time.
Lived very close to her mother, had a great relationship with her family. They were a typical sort of the earth type family, very, very close, told each other everything. Lived in a nice flat in Battersea, just had no problems, was starting a lovely life with her boyfriend.
Angie Brewer lived in the flat downstairs from Crystal, so in the same building, but she had the ground floor of the house. Angie was considerably older than Crystal, probably 25 or 30 years older, and she'd had a life where she'd had episodes of sort of addiction and difficulties with her mental health, and I think it's fair to say that she wasn't a model neighbour, and she would complain about virtually anything that didn't fit in with how she wanted things to be it where the rubbish bags were put or noise or anything like that. And she would complain not only to the Housing Association but also to the local police. And the local neighbourhood police team there knew Angie Brewer very well.
Neighbourhood police officers' bread and butter is neighbourhood disputes. Anyone living in close proximity with their neighbours can have disagreements. Some of these escalate, and some of them, there's no reasoning to them, because certain neighbours will have a dispute with anyone who lives next door to them.
There'd been a number of calls to the house. Most of them really, when called by Angie Brewer, they found to be kind of groundless. But there'd been conflict between Angie and Crystal Hart. That had been documented by police. Lawyers had got involved. And so the relationship between the two ladies who lived in the flats on their own wasn't great. Thomas Hughes is, in many ways, a sad character. He's another local. His family had owned a house just less than half a mile from where Crystal lived through three generations since it was built in Victorian times. And he lived there with his mother, although he was in his 40s. He lived there with his mother, who was very aged and very infirm.
I first knew of Thomas Hughes when I very first joined the police, and at that time I was stationed in Battersea. And at that time, Tommy Hughes was one of our prolific subjects and somebody who would be stopped by police a lot for minor crime, sort of car crime and general antisocial behaviour, possibly burglaries, robberies, that sort of crime.
I think I described him as a wannabe gangster, and I think that's pretty sort of accurate. He dabbled in drugs, mostly soft drugs, cannabis, but he kind of sold some every now and then, and he liked people to think that he was well-connected and that he was more important in that kind of world than he really was.
He'd been convicted of putting a screwdriver in a female friend's neck in another attack. And he was given an 18-month sentence. Now, to my mind, that indicates someone who has a hatred of women, as well as being a wannabe, a gangster type, someone that wanted to show off.
Angie Brewer and Thomas Hughes had a connection in their kind of lifestyle. Neither had a job. They had a lot of time on their hands. Two people who'd drifted together and had common interests, laying about, drinking, and they sort of got on. But I think that it was a very uneven partnership, because I think Thomas Hughes would have wanted it to be a sort of formal relationship where Angie Brewer just saw him as, you know, a friend who came around and she smoked and drank with sometimes. He'd no doubt heard chapter and verse from Angie Brewer about what an awful neighbour Crystal was, and he decided the way to get into her good books, to impress her, was to deal with it.
I can only imagine he became entwined because Angela was escalating it to him and probably exaggerating it to him. I can't stand this noise. Look what I'm having to put up with. It's terrible here.
And I guess it came as a surprise to many that he actually had a firearm. It's probably even more surprising that he went and used that gun, and he used it to shoot and kill Crystal Hart. Angie Brewer had made a decision, I suppose, in this circumstance and after this incident, and her decision was that she was going to assist the police and tell the police whatever she could about what went on. And so she was the first person to give us a kind of accurate account of the events of that morning.
Angie Brewer, the neighbour, had witnessed the murder, and she'd said her boyfriend had committed the murder. So immediately we knew that we had an outstanding suspect.
I became aware of the case shortly after it had happened, when the team I was working on were allocated the investigation. So it would have been probably the day after she'd been murdered. One of my colleagues was kind of witness liaison with Angie Brewer, and sometimes I went along with her because Angie was such a handful to deal with. She was the neighbour of Crystal Hart at the time and played a large role in what was to very sadly unfold.
She told us that she had a boyfriend or a friend who was a man called Thomas Hughes, who lived, you know, less than half a mile away, and that he used to come round and bring things for her. And she kind of said herself that he wasn't her boyfriend, but she thought he had quite a soft spot for her and probably would like to have been her boyfriend. Earlier that morning, being Good Friday, he'd been round and he'd knocked on her door at about 9 o'clock or just after and brought her an Easter egg. And that when he went, he'd seen a man called David, who was Crystal Hart's boyfriend, partner, although he didn't live there, but he was there, and that there'd been some words exchanged between Hughes and David.
David had left to go to work that morning, had, as I recall, slammed the gate, allegedly. Hughes had turned up with an Easter egg and they'd had words outside, just outside the house. David had taken down the registration number of Mr. Hughes, and maybe that had sent him over the edge.
She said Thomas Hughes had gone away and then come back again about half an hour later, and she'd heard him bang on the door that led upstairs to Crystal's flat. And because he was making such a noise banging on the door, she kind of came to her front door, but she says she didn't open it. She was just listening to what was going on. And she heard Crystal come down the stairs and open the front door, and there were just a few words, and the next thing she heard was gunshots. And she heard a couple of gunshots, and she opened her front door and looked out, and she saw Thomas Hughes walking away with a revolver in his hand, going to his Volkswagen Golf car and driving away.
When he was banging on Crystal's door that morning, Angela came to her door and opened it a crack, and she actually witnessed the murder. She basically said she was as shocked as anyone else when he turned up with a gun and shot her. As soon as we got there, we were pretty much aware that it was over nonsense. And then we went off to meet Crystal's family to try and get some background.
Crystal's family, her mother and aunts, lived nearby, and we went round to see them at their flat nearby, and her mother was obviously completely distraught about things, but the family were able to give us an awful lot of the background about what had been going on with Angie Brewer, and it kind of added a dimension to the whole case.
We attended the address, which was very close to where the incident happened. I attended with Colin and a family liaison officer. They'd already had an inkling because it was such a close-knit area. I think when we actually confirmed that it was Crystal and she had died, absolute devastation. How do you come to terms with that? Just the sense of loss and the sense of permanency to it, and no one could really speak.
So it was during that meeting, with that initial meeting with Crystal's family, that we were given the bombshell that we didn't know at that up to that point, that Crystal had been pregnant, that she was in fact 3 months pregnant. And so Thomas Hughes had killed not only her, but her unborn child.
And then to find out that she had a baby, or was expecting a baby as well, it was just difficult to comprehend that morning. That morning was a very, very sad morning for a lot of people.
We heard about the existence of the CCTV that was going to give us a good idea of what went on.
Both families had put CCTV on the front of their properties to show the disputes that were or were not taking place. Crystal had put CCTV on her front garden to show that they weren't slamming the gates, there wasn't a lot of noise, because it had sound and vision, just to prove their point, because it wasn't going to go away.
And we went from there back to our offices at Putney, and that was where I first viewed the CCTV, and it was so clear. It's one of those unusual investigations where we know exactly what happened and we know exactly who did it. And when we were able to retrieve the recording from that morning, it confirmed almost exactly what Angie Brewer had told us. We saw the visit by Thomas Hughes bringing her the Easter egg. We saw him leave. We saw him come back. We saw him with the gun in his hand. We heard the shots. We saw him leave with the gun in his hand.
The CCTV clearly showed Hughes arriving at the house and going to the front door. He moves out of camera range, but the microphone clearly picked up what happened next. The audio was too graphic to be broadcast, but Hughes says to Angela Brewer, "Is he in? Is he in? Try that doorbell now. Knock on the door." Angela Brewer replied, "I can't, I can't." Hughes is then heard shouting at Crystal, "Come out, bitch, I've had enough." Brewer is then heard screaming as Hughes pulls out the gun. Brewer says, "No, no, oh my God, no." Then there is a shot. 3 seconds later, a second shot. And the CCTV shows as Hughes calmly walks away, leaving Crystal Hart dead in her doorway.
He executed her by shooting her twice through the head. She didn't... just senseless, absolutely senseless. And horrific.
His actions were so grossly and obscenely disproportionate to what the row was about. It was an innocuous row by all accounts.
Neighbour disputes, where people fall out with their next-door neighbour or their downstairs neighbour or something, is very rarely settled by a shooting. You know, you might have a fight or a bit of damage or something like that and police get called, but for it to escalate where it's solved and resolved by... somebody shooting somebody is, you know, I hadn't come across it before.
Crystal's murder was a terrible crime because she was completely innocent young woman. She was pregnant and she opened the door to him and he shot her twice, point blank range, and for no reason, not that there ever could be a reason for doing that.
He didn't take on her boyfriend. Her boyfriend had left. So he went back to get Crystal, who is seen as the easy target because he's a coward.
He needed to be arrested, and the sooner the better.
The most important thing at this point for Colin and his colleagues would have been to track Hughes down as quickly as possible, because you've got a man here armed with a revolver who's just shot a young woman dead for no apparent good reason. Quite clearly, he would have been deemed a danger to the public and indeed the police.
Basically, we had a man with a gun on the loose, a very dangerous man, because he's executed one woman for no reason, as far as we were concerned, and he had nothing to lose. Once you're looking at life imprisonment, however many murders you complete, you still can only get life imprisonment.
We know exactly what happened, and we know exactly who did it, and what his name is, and what his car registration is, and what his mobile phone number is, because Angie Brewer was giving us all this because she had little choice to, really. It was just a question of finding him. It was, you know, literally was a manhunt.
It was so much more serious than any crime that I know of that he'd committed before.
The mainstay of our efforts to find him was always going to be his mobile phone, because we quickly got the authority for his service provider to give us live updates of where that phone was triangulating on which masts. So I was happy that the intelligence people were going to get up on his phone, and we could mount that part of the operation very quickly. We then had the home address to search, and we go down to Stonards Road, round the corner, and there's this collapsing house.
Obviously, we knew his name immediately, and he'd decamped from the scene, and the first place that you would look would be the home address. His home was nearby, and we went straight round there to see if we could see his car outside the address.
And then we had to go and try and find Thomas Hughes.
Yeah, and find out where he was, and he lived with his mum, didn't he?
He lived with his mum, but he lived like... You could walk it virtually, couldn't you? It was so close. So, because we knew that he lived this close and lived with his mother. And difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, you and I were here and we know that he's adrift with a gun. And you just got to hope that we're sort of driving our... I think we were in the old green Zafira, weren't we? And, you know, you sort of just hope that it's sort of car that a couple might drive or something like that, and that nobody's going to really know it's a police vehicle. It was here in Stonewalls Road that Thomas Hughes lived.
It's a beautiful road. His house was derelict, it had subsidence, it just stood out. His mother, a very, very elderly mother, was living there with him in total disrepair. When we arrived, our building surveyor said no one can go upstairs. We had to have scaffolding around the outside before we could go in and search it. The mother was living in absolute abject poverty on her own. He'd pop in when he wanted.
We were genuinely frightened it was going to fall down while we were searching it. And they conducted the search. We found his mother in absolute squalor, and we took her away eventually to go somewhere where she could be cared for, because he clearly didn't care for her. And when the search was completed, it was the only thing we found of any note was that hidden behind some loose bricks at the back of the house was a cloth that had been used to wrap or to wipe a gun, and a few rounds of ammunition which may or may not have fitted the gun that he had.
The suspect, Tommy Hughes, disappeared and went on the run, and there was various work done undercover to find out where he was.
The kind of forensic work at the scene and the ordinary stuff was all taking place, but the focus very much and the priority very much was to find this man. It wasn't going to be difficult to prove he'd committed the murder because we had pictures and sound of him doing it, but it was just finding him and finding him protecting the public from a gunman who'd just killed somebody and was still armed.
The team did some work around locating his mobile phone, and that showed us where he was going, but any notification we had of his whereabouts was 5 minutes behind where he actually was, so it wasn't possible to catch up with him that way.
It's a funny sort of business, chasing somebody who you know's got a gun and who's killed somebody, and you haven't got a gun.
Yeah, but you don't really think about that, do you?
You don't, because...
Until you come face to face with
them. Yeah. I mean, you know that 99.9% of the time things like that will be safe and will be okay. And I guess we just all sort of trusted to that, didn't we?
Yeah.
We all trust to that and it will be all right. He moved about a great deal for the rest of that day into the early hours of the Saturday morning. And it was difficult thing for us to do because you have to try and keep sufficient people there to respond, to try to cut him off and to lay eyes on him and arrest him. You've got the difficulty that there's still a scene going on, there's still a family to be dealt with and consoled and the things that we need to do there. So half the team were having to do things which weren't directed towards finding Thomas Hughes. And all the time, you've got the fact that he's murdered somebody with a gun, and you don't have that gun, and we hadn't recovered that gun.
The pressure was huge because he had shot and executed an unarmed woman for what we could see as no reason. So what was to stop him shooting anyone else? So intense pressure, because you're trying to save other people. You don't know what state of mind he's in. He's a dangerous man.
We couldn't be armed and we couldn't have armed officers with us during this search for him. Something like looking for a man who's committed a murder with a gun of itself, on its own, isn't sufficient justification. So it would be difficult to know how we would get armed assistance. It was really one of those cases where we had to kind of suck it and see, and we had to try and find where he was and locate him and then make a decision about how we approached him to try and take him into custody.
Until you actually know where he is, there's not enough armed response to deal with where he could be. So we've got to try and find him as well as they were trying to find him.
Myself and Joe Brunt and the other members of the team who were hurtling around South London trying to find this man who'd killed with a gun were armed with a stick and some CS spray, that was all. While we were looking at Thomas Hughes's phone to try and use it to locate him, and he was on the run, what we did see was that he was using it to send text messages to Andrew Brewer. Of course, we don't know what the content of those messages were, but it was clear that he was still communicating with her. You know, she kind of really washed her hands of all this and says there's nothing to do with it.
Using technology, we're able to follow his movements via his mobile phone. However, because he was in his car and the movements were only being made available after a certain time period, they were constantly catching up with him. So he'd go from one place, his phone would ping at another place, and the police would arrive a few minutes later and no sign of him.
So with regard to the manhunt, when you've got a man on the loose with a gun, obviously our priority is to find him and protect life. There's no knowing what he could do. He was obviously driving around and we were following it. Several members of the team in different cars were following it as well as we could, and it was took us around Wandsworth, Battersea.
Down out on the A3 towards sort of Maldon, Rushett, and then across to Morden, back down the A3 to Epsom and Ewell and Hook. And then he seemed to be stationary there for a bit, and then it was on the move again. We were told it was heading around the M25 and then down the M23 towards Gatwick.
We've got a wanted man, so if you've got a dangerous wanted man, you put out what's called an all ports alert. So you let all the agencies know that we're looking for this wanted man. And obviously Gatwick would have been aware, and when he was going towards Gatwick, we would have made them very aware to look for Thomas Hughes. He didn't go into Gatwick. He was just circulating the area, maybe looking for a flight, who knows. But he came away from there.
We're literally just turning off on the slip road from the M23 to go into the airport. We had another message to say, no, it's back up towards Chessington again. And we're back to there. And eventually it was around near Hook Arena, between Chessington and Hook, that the signal stabilised and stayed overnight. So we then had a number of different vehicles of ours. You know, these are people who have been working now for 16, 17 hours non-stop on this, myself included.
We're all very tired, but the adrenaline takes over and you just want to catch this man.
Most of us would like to go and get some sleep at some time because we know we're going to be busy tomorrow as well. But the imperative to find this man, to find the gun, means, you know, it's all hands to the pumps.
We all spread out and drove up and down all the streets that we could find looking for this car. But it could have been in a garage, it could... There's always places that you can hide a car for people who don't know the area. The locals were informed, so overnight street searches were taking place up and down all around Hook. And it's a big area you have to cover, and it's very highly populated. We didn't find it, and during the night, the mobile phone powered off. So either he turned it off or it ran out of battery, but that means that was its last place. It could have moved on at any time.
I think at this point, you've got to put yourselves in the mind of the actual murder squad detectives who were not armed, but they were involved in trying to track him down. They knew full well what he'd done to Crystal. They knew that he was not only armed, but he was dangerous.
You were driving around thinking, oh, is he here? Hoping against hope that you'd see the car before he saw you, because however much you like to think that you don't stand out, police officers in suits in a car do stand out, and everyone can say, oh, they're police officers, and he would be no different to that. And so you're hoping that you see him before he sees you because he's got a gun and you haven't.
And it got probably to about 5 a.m. and we were satisfied we'd driven up and down every single street, car park, piece of land where that VW Golf could have been parked, and we couldn't find it. And so at that point, we had to kind of call it a day and go in, and it was literally a couple of hours sleep and back the next morning to carry on.
We were looking everywhere for obviously Thomas and his gun, and this pond came into the inquiry just because it was so close to the scene and it's somewhere that he could have thrown the gun.
I think it's the third time, only the third time ever, that I used our divers, and it's the first time they never found anything. It's a very difficult thing to search in there. It's very dirty, although it's shallow. Who knows? Mud at the bottom. Thomas Hughes's gun could still be there. We never recovered it. The information we had that Thomas Hughes had a boat on the River Thames moored somewhere near Richmond, kind of a little bit odd in some ways, because, you know, there were some boats there that are pretty expensive and the moorings are pretty expensive, and we kind of think that was out of Thomas Hughes's league somewhat. But when we got there to find it, it was just really a kind of a small dinghy with an outboard motor and a canvas cover on the top.
The boat in Richmond was symptomatic of his house. It was just a ramshackle, probably not even river-worthy. There's no way anyone could have slept there, because that was somewhere where we thought he might have gone. Just a dump of a boat that was worth nothing.
And so it was kind of lunchtime the following day when I came to the conclusion that it was time to go public with his name and with his car details, and let's try and enlist the help of, you know, millions of Londoners to look for this car and this man.
We're a very useful tool for the police to try and apprehend offenders, and particularly where an offender has gone on the run, is missing, and the police are looking to find that person. In this instance, you had a very dangerous and armed individual, strongly suspected to have murdered a young woman for what would have been the most innocuous of reasons, the most pathetic of reasons. So the police went public, identified him, put his face out, all and sundry.
There's certain things that have to be, certain boxes that have to be ticked if you're going to go to the media with a name, with a live manhunt. And the most important thing is to save life.
The police knew who, they clearly knew who they were looking for. They could have used their own resources to try and find this person, but the balance that they will use is one of public safety versus investigative integrity. And in this instance, the public safety was the most important factor.
And the second thing is, have you got the right man? Because if you went live with the wrong person, who knows what could happen? We were 100% certain we had the right man. We had it on CCTV. We also were 100% certain we had a very dangerous man on the loose.
In this case, I thought it was justified because there was still a real risk that Thomas Hughes was in possession of a gun and ammunition and so could present a danger to members of the public. So there wasn't going to be a question of identification, evidence and an ID parade or anything like that. And so it was safe to put his name and picture of his car out to the media.
Unfortunately, you get answers from everywhere. You've got sightings in Scotland, you've got sightings in Ireland, you've got... So although we need the public's help, we need several people to say it's in Battersea, or we need several people, because you've got sightings all over the country and it can sometimes be more of a hindrance.
It appeared on the lunchtime local news in London, and within half an hour of that going out, we had a phone call from somebody not a million miles away from the scene, but still in Battersea, who said, that black gull's been outside my side fence around the corner from my house, and it's been there for the last couple of days. So it looks like what Hughes had actually done was dump the car there and then use the train. There's a nearby railway station, and all this travel about that where we'd been looking for the black gull the night before, he'd been on public transport, so we were never going to find him that way.
Within a matter of hours of his details being released, it was Hughes himself who gave himself up and walked into Battersea Police Station. It was a very good example of police using the media to protect the public.
Out of the blue, the incident room received a phone call to say that Hughes had turned up at Battersea Police Station, said that people are looking for him, and obviously the police officers at Battersea were aware that he could be armed, so they'd left him in the front counter on the public side, phoned us and said, your man's here sitting waiting for the police to arrive.
Walked in and said, oh, I understand the police want to speak to me. So I thought, that's very good. I said, OK, well, is he in custody, is he? And they said, well, not exactly, no. What's happened is he came in and said that he was Thomas Hughes, and we kind of looked it up and we realised that he's armed and could be dangerous. So what we've done is we've asked him to sit in the front office and wait for an armed response vehicle to come. He doesn't know that, obviously, and we're waiting for them to come so they can arrest him. This man giving himself up for a murder. And rather than taking him into custody, they said, can you take a seat in the waiting room, please, sir? And then called for their armed colleagues to come and arrest him.
When I heard that he'd been arrested for the murder of Crystal Hart, it was quite shocking to see how his criminal life had progressed into that.
Everything turned out OK. He played the game and he waited there in the front office, and the armed response vehicle turned up and he was arrested and delivered to us.
I would say that a very dangerous man at that point was taken off the streets.
Although we took his clothes and submitted them for analysis, that didn't give us any evidence. But we didn't need it. We had this film, which, you know, was all the evidence we really needed. And so he was interviewed, and like most people being under investigation for serious offences, he was advised not to give any comment to any of the questions we put to him. So everything was put to him. He just monotonely repeated no comment. What's interesting is he didn't actually come up with any defence or any idea of what he might have done and why it wasn't him and why we had the wrong man. So it wasn't really until we came to trial at the Old Bailey that we first found out what Thomas Hughes' defence might be.
He basically denied being involved in any way, shape or form. He admitted he had attended Angela's address that morning to give her an Easter egg. He had left, and someone looking like him, dressed like him, had later attended and had murdered Crystal.
Hughes bizarrely tried to claim that it wasn't him. It didn't take the jury very long to see through it.
He had nothing to lose. He was looking at life imprisonment. I presume he just thought, I'll give this a run. Well, I'll keep saying it's not me, and I might have a jury member or a few jury members who believe me, so I'm going to keep going with that and hopefully get off. Obviously, he didn't. Thank goodness for everyone else.
He was convicted, and when sentencing him, the judge said that this was amounted to, for all intents and purposes, a ruthless execution and a truly evil act. And he said that Hughes would have to serve at least 30 years of his life sentence before he could even apply for parole, which makes him something like 70 years old before he's even got a chance of being out of prison.
He's not going to be a danger by the time he comes out. He's going to be an old man and his life basically is over.
Sentencing Hughes to life imprisonment with a minimum term of 30 years, the judge said the murder was a ruthless execution and a truly evil act. And the fact that Hughes had done it for his girlfriend was, he said, evidence of his warped mentality.
it shows you that even at that point, when he must have realised, woken up, seen what he'd actually done, it was almost as if he couldn't face up to what he'd done. There was nothing brave or worthy of kudos about what he did.
There was no need whatsoever for Thomas Hughes to involve himself in this argument. It wasn't his argument, and he took away two lives, not only Crystal, but her unborn child. And it's quite interesting, just another kind of curious thing, is that Hughes's case came to court not very long, just a matter of a week or two, after Levi Belfield was sentenced to three whole life terms in my other case.
I understand he spent some time in Belmarsh Prison, where he met my nemesis, Levi Belfield, and apparently they became some type of friends, which doesn't surprise me at all. Same type of people stick together. Got nothing good to say about either of them.
Strangely enough, they formed a bit of a friendship, so much so that Belfield was heard talking on the phone from prison to his brother about his mate Tom and how terrible it was that he'd got 30 years for this crime.
And in fact, Belfield had referred to the Hughes case and Colin, Joe, Clive and the other members of his team being involved in that in the most disparaging of terms. Well, if Levi Belfield is writing something awful about you in this context, I can only assume that you are doing something correct.
Certainly from what I've heard from his conversations with Levi Belfield in prison, I get the impression that Thomas Hughes feels that he was hard done by, that his sentence was too severe. My view of it is he was extremely lucky just to get away with 30 years.
He had no remorse because he didn't admit he'd done it. So, no. Totally unfazed by it all.
He was a insignificant, rather weedy, scruffy individual that had just taken someone's life for no reason. So it's hard really to think of him as anything other than that.